Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, this is Ryan. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about all things music, bands, stories behind songs, albums, all things music. And today, I'm really excited to be talking about the Rolling Stones. In this conversation, I'm talking with Blair Thomas, whose name you might recognize. He was on episode 2, if you go way back, episode 2 of the podcast that we spoke on Radiohead's song Idiotech. Blair is a Dallas-based video director and producer, and he's a friend, and we were talking, and I'm sure you were like this, where if you were way into music, I'm sure you're like this, where you're, you know, texting your buddies or you talk to your buddies about music, or in some way talk about music works its way into conversations. And so he had made the comment of, hey, don't you think that the Stones had a kind of like a second coming in the middle of the 60s once Keith Richards landed on that open tuning? They really had a whole new launch to their career. And this has been talked about, but it really struck a chord with me. I was like, man, I struck a chord. I thought that was so accurate. And, you know, we start looking at the songs that were written after Keith Richards landed on this new open guitar tuning, which we'll talk about here in just a minute. But it's cool to be able to take a band like the Stones that have such a, you have a gut reaction. You heard me say the Rolling Stones and you had a feeling. You thought, oh, they're great. Or you might have thought, eh. But it's interesting because, like, when a band is so big, you've had some kind of interaction with them. They've played their song too much on the radio, or you really love that one B-side, or you've got some kind of feeling for it, right? And so we kind of go into that talking deeper about, you know, the merits of a band like this, who you may have come in contact with a lot. They played in town. They play them on the radio. I don't like them. Or, you know, I'm all in for every song. It's just interesting when you hit a band that is massively huge, but also has depth and has songs to back up the quality, the hype. They have a reason for the hype. And so I think that's true for the Beatles too. You know, that's another gigantic band where people, you can love them, you can hate them, but in most cases you've come in contact with them. Anyway, so we're talking about the Rolling Stones, their second act, if you will, from the mid to late 60s and on. So let's head on over to the interview. This is Blair Thomas. Hey, Blair, I'm so happy to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on to talk about the Stones today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've been looking forward to it. Yeah, this will be a lot of fun.
Man, I love talking to you about music, and you were on episode 2 of the podcast where we talked about Radiohead's Idiotech. And I feel like you and I have known each other for several years now. And I feel like many of the times that we've talked, you and I have landed back on the Stones, and we've kind of started talking about certain Stones songs, or you would tell me about like the Black and Blue album, or like, have you heard this song? And while I feel like I knew a lot of Stones songs, I feel like you were somebody who's helped me to see more of the Stones and to see them in a different way. And it's cool how this episode kind of shaped up. You and I were talking or texting, and you had brought up how the Stones really had two eras, so to speak, of creativity, and how we're kind of talking about they had a resurgence kind of in the mid 60s. And so this is an episode I'm really excited about to be talking about them. So one, thanks for coming on the show again.
Yeah, well, I'm so excited, and I'm so proud to have already been on the most popular and downloaded podcast, episode 2. I know that's the one that people are still talking about. it's the Rolling Stones of podcast episodes. You're right. I mean, we do. That's one thing I love about our friendship is that, we can just, you know, bump into each other or just start texting. Something will make one of us think about a band or a song, and then we can go back and forth and talk about it. But, you know, that's a blast. I love doing that. That's like one of my favorite things. So
me too.
Yeah. I mean, with the Stones, absolutely. I think that there are kind of multiple eras of the Stones. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times people kind of land on one, and they think that that defines the band. And mm-hmm. That's tough because, you know, it's like, no, don't write them off. I mean, there are some people who think, yeah, well, I mean, Satisfaction just, that isn't my thing. I mean, Satisfaction and Paint It Black, I mean, those, they play those on the radio all the time. And right. Yeah, I just don't like the Stones. And I can totally sympathize with that. And in yep. fact, the Stones, I mean, I was well into my 20s. No, I was almost into my 30s when, and I was still someone who said, oh man, I hate the Rolling Stones.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, I was very loyal to the Beatles. And
me too.
I always felt like you had to pick.
Pick a side. Yeah, I did too.
And so I had that. And really it was because I'm telling you, I have to kind of blame the radio. And I hate to do that, but it's like, man, there were a few songs that they would play to death. And it was like, oh man, I'm so sick of these Stone songs. And it wasn't until really some of the 70s era, the mid to late 70s era Stone songs, and we can get to that, but some of those where I just had to admit, I was like, man, I'll just tell you, like one of them, my big gateway Rolling Stone song is Beast of Burden.
Oh, great song.
And yeah, it's, I mean, to me, and we can talk more about that later when we talk about different, you know, lead guitar players, but it was just, it's just undeniably perfect. You know, like I love that song. And really, between that and Miss You, that's one of my other favorites, same album. But that, it was like, yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, I think maybe I do really like the Stones. And then the more I started to dig in, it was like, man, I think I actually love the Stones.
Yeah, that's funny. I had such a similar experience where I feel like it was fed to me that you had to pick one or the other, because it was always like, oh, it's the Stones or the Beatles. Can't be both. And man, you know, for me, the gateway was the Exile on Main Street album. And I don't remember, I think it's just that I kept seeing on top album lists. And I was like, I just kept sitting with it and kept sitting with it. And then all of a sudden it was like, this is incredible. And I have really kind of been writing this off just because based on my love for the Beatles. But let's talk about bands that are interesting in the way that you can love one album from them and hate another album. You had mentioned Radiohead was a band where that's a band where you can have one album that is completely different from another. You can love one album and then hate the next. Why did you say Radiohead, and what other bands come to mind for you?
Absolutely with Radiohead. In fact, I don't know that there could be another band that kind of illustrates that, at least that I know of or that I can think of right now. But with Radiohead, oh man, I mean, if you listen to, I'll go back all the way, we'll go all the way back to Pablo Honey. Take it to the very beginning. You yeah. listen to Pablo Honey and, you know, and then you go on to the Bends. Then you love Radiohead because you love, you know, their guitar, the melody, you know, you love kind of that passion, you know, all the way, even with after the Bends, you can do OK Computer and you're like, OK, this is getting interesting. But yeah, man, I love some of these songs. And then all of a sudden out of nowhere, Kid A comes out. And I mean, it sounds like you accidentally put the wrong album on. I mean, and I will never forget. I remember the first time hearing actually every Radiohead album. And cool. My friends warned me, you know, like, well, I'm just telling you, Kid A is amazing, but just know it is not going to be. Yeah, be prepared. And especially because I just love guitar so much.
Yeah.
And but yeah, and then if you really loved Amnesiac, let's just say, which to me is as far out as they go, or at least they went for the main, like, you know, main era Radiohead. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, what are the odds that someone who just heard a song from Amnesiac and fell in love and loved that album would then go back and listen to the Bends and love it?
Yeah.
It's like, it's possible, but I don't know, man. It's
those are very different bands between those two albums.
They really are. And I mean, I hate to say it. And I do think that, you know, especially with an album like In Rainbows, they found a way. I don't know if this, I mean, it just so happened that with an album like In Rainbows, yeah, they swung back around and it's like, oh, okay, Tom York got to do all that weird stuff and Johnny Greenwood, but you know, they found their guitar again and they, you know, decided that, you know, they'd have fun with melodies again. And so anyway, yeah, Radiohead is the perfect example for that.
Is there another band where you love the, where you can love them and hate them?
So I will say that, yes, I think that with the Talking Heads, or I should say Talking Heads, that's one of my favorite bands. Absolutely. And clearly, Radiohead was heavily influenced by Talking Heads. I mean, all the way down to the coming up with the name for the band.
Yeah.
And, the idea that you could kind of evolve and change from album to album to album. And Talking Heads did that. And you could have one, I mean, the first two, like, you know, 77 and more songs about buildings and food or buildings and people. I can't believe I'm blanking on it now because it's because I'm having to talk about it. But, you know, incredible albums, you know, Fear of Music. But then you start to go further down the road. And then they got into just, you know, heavy kind of synth experimental. Even Fear of Music has some of that within their more experimental, the back half of the album.
Yeah.
But then as they went on, and then it evolved into one that was more kind of upbeat and cheery, and I would almost say kind of flat, just not overly interesting to me. I hate to say that, but some of the last two, maybe three albums from Talking Heads are like that. And so, man, if I just heard those albums, I would just think this band does nothing for me. I mean, it makes me think of something from my childhood that I don't like. Like, I don't know why I have such an aversion to the last couple of albums, whereas the first four, I think, are perfect albums. It's just, whereas a lot of bands, I guess they just find their thing. This is our sound. And it's just like rinse and repeat for their whole career, you know? But I feel like best bands don't do that.
Right. I mean, it, for me, like the measurement is always the Beatles for me. For any band that can hold their weight, it's like, okay, well, I'm going to compare them to what I think is the best band, and that's the Beatles. And what the Beatles did was evolve. And so it's almost like they have set the standard for you start as one thing, and in your time to shine, what can you do with it? You know, so the Beatles took great songs and then evolved in creativity and more creativity and just hit a creative peak pinnacle in my mind as to like, gosh, the amount of years between the Beatles being a light pop band and then doing like Sgt. Pepper was so short. And so when you hold that up to other bands, it's like, well, what can you do? You know, can you change like that? And it's cool when bands can, and it's unimpressive to me when bands can, when it's just rinse and repeat, like you said. And you know, the Stones are really a band that had so many different sounds. They've been around for so long. They started as one kind of like pop rock in the 60s and then turned into like the most creative type rock through the like late 60s and 70s, dabbled in almost disco beats a little bit with Miss You, and then back into the 80s and back into like creating new classic rock. Like it's really pretty interesting. The amount of sounds they've had. But you know, when you talk about having an aversion to the Stones, do you think there's like I feel like the bands that are that big, they have a persona. Like you think of the word the Rolling Stones, and I picture the Andy Warhol, what drawing of Mick Jagger's lips or whatever. It's like it is a outsized version of the thing that they have created. But like when you and I were talking earlier, it was like, well, they made some really beautiful things as well. It's just we've been saturated with Stones hits throughout the years, so it can be easy to miss the beautiful things they did. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. No, I think that's really true. And I think that the Rolling Stones, I think a lot of bands, this is true of a lot of bands, but as an analogy, I think that you can look at some bands as almost like someone you become good friends with over the years. You know, I think of like a college era friendship, where when you first meet them, and so this would be like that early era, the kind of the Brian Jones era of the Stones, where you first meet them, it's like freshman year, and everybody's like, oh yeah, they're fun. It's just casual. It's, you know, it's just kind of a social acquaintance, and you see them around, and yeah, they're nice enough, and there's some really, you know, fun, cool things about them. But then as you can become closer friends with them, like you have, you know, something that kind of brings you together and you develop more of an actual friendship. And to me, a lot of people don't get past that freshman year era, which is the early era of the Stones, but that sophomore era, which is, I think when they, especially when they brought in Mick Taylor and some of the changes that Keith Richards made with, you know, kind of the nature of the guitar and how he played the guitar, then it transitioned into this where it's like, wow, that, you know, like you would tell people, you know, you're friends with someone and say, oh yeah, you know, I've, you know, we started hanging out a bunch and, or we worked at, you know, we worked at a camp together over the summer or whatever. And I've had many times where I'm like, you know, actually, you know, they can be really deep, you know, like, yeah, believe it or not, like, man, that guy or girl or whatever. It's like, man, you know, we had some really great conversations. You'd be surprised. You know, like I know that like, that's just something that people will say of their friends to, when they're talking to other people. Oh, you'd be surprised. Like they can actually have a really deep conversation. And there's a lot to that person. And I feel like with the Stones, people, they never were given the opportunity. And, you know, you mentioned Exile. Well, yeah, I mean, that to me, it's not my favorite album, but Exile is undeniably their masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Go down the list of every song on Exile. There is not a single radio hit. I mean, the closest you would get is Tumbling Dice.
Yeah.
But even then, you ask, I would say you could ask almost any just casual music fan, like radio, they would not know Tumbling Dice. So what other bands? Oh yeah. Tumbling Dice is amazing. I mean, that album, there's so many good songs, but I can't think of another band where the one that every fan says is the masterpiece has zero hits.
That's a good point. I mean, even like you think of like Sgt. Pepper, I'm trying to think what other are like landmark albums, but that's definitely a good point. Well, let's hone in on the guitar thing, because I think that that's really where this started. And the way that this started was you had said the Stones ran out of songs in the 60s and were headed for like a short run. And then Keith Richards discovers this open tuning and basically unlocked a huge reservoir of songs. That's how this whole episode came to be. And I started thinking about that. And it was like, I mean, that's completely true. And do you play guitar? I can't remember.
No, I mean, I do, any song that's like two chords, I can destroy it as long as it isn't like F or,
something I can tell you as a guitar guy, like especially after you play guitar for a long time, your fingers get locked into patterns and you know that when I go here, it sounds like this, and you just out of like, whatever that is, muscle memory, you start going to the same places. So anytime that, and for people listening who don't play an instrument, Keith Richards used something called the open G tuning. And that means he would tune the guitar differently. So instead of having to play a G chord, which is a chord that uses four of your fingers to play all the notes, you can take your left hand off the guitar and just strum it open. And it sounds like a G chord. And anytime I've ever messed with open tunings, it is really fun because you have to throw out all the knowledge you have. And unless you know the chord voicings, you're just playing in the dark. It's like playing a piano with your eyes closed, and you land on some really interesting stuff. And so I think that's what happened to Keith Richards, is I think that he found this tuning and was like, oh my gosh, it must have been like finding the guitar all over again. Because like you said, so many classic songs came out of this. I'm just gonna name a couple. That are recorded in the open G tuning. It's Beast of Burden, Give Me Shelter, Holy Cow, Start Me Up, Happy, and Can You Hear Me Knock? Can't You Hear Me Knock? And just some great songs. But I think that was such an interesting point you made on, gosh, they got like a whole second wind. This could have been a band we never heard from again by the year 1966 if this hadn't happened, possibly.
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned the Beatles a minute ago, and that's actually a great, that is like a parallel analogy to the same thing. So the Beatles, they had that Beatles poppy sound, you know, like, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Love Me Do, all that stuff. Well, they were limited by being able to perform live. Mm-hmm. And so every song they wrote, their instrumentation and arrangement and everything they did all went through, of their brains thinking, how can we do this live? What would this look like if we toured? Well, then they finally got to a point where they said, well, what if we remove that restriction? What if we don't want to tour anymore? You know, what if we didn't have to do that and we could just write songs we wanted to write? That removing that restriction is what unlocked the best music that they ever wrote.
Agreed.
I mean, in my opinion. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't have Abbey Road, Sgt. Pepper, the White Album. You wouldn't have any of that stuff. And with the Stones, it's the same way, where Keith Richards, I think that he, you know, just being so fascinated by, you know, guitar music and just music in general. And really, you know, Keith Richards was someone who would just dig and dig and dig. And there are so many stories about things he discovered when he was just doing his kind of, you know, whatever independent research, you know, like archaeology and into rock and blues and especially American music. There's some amazing things were discovered, but one of them is in his digging. And my understanding, is that so much of what was determined as far as guitar was based on the guitar manufacturers, like the mass produced guitars, that they would tune the guitars the way guitars are still traditionally tuned. But that wasn't, I think his point was that other stringed instruments don't do it that way. And he started to think, well, it has more to do with Sears than anything, you know, like just mass producing guitars for America. So he realized, you know, he discovered this open tuning. And I mean, he didn't invent it, but he discovered it, you know, for himself. And he said that once he did that, but yes, I mean, they had written all these songs. They had several hits, several very popular albums, but the music itself had kind of run its course. And he says that it was basically like discovering this huge reservoir underground. And it was as though he couldn't write songs fast enough. And it just unlocked. Yeah. Like, as you said, it just unlocked everything. And I would say they would have had, I mean, I'm sure they could have had a few more years, but their best music was ahead of them. And once he did that, I think that, you know, especially, you know, hardcore Stones fans, you know, for sure would say, all of those the best songs by far came after that.
For sure. And you know, it's even interesting when you listen to those songs. You and I both talked about how we read the Keith Richards biography. What is it? Life, I think is what it's called. And I'm going to botch this because I don't remember exactly, but I think what he said is he would record those riffs on the acoustic guitar into like a tape deck. And then I think they would put the tape deck, run it back into the board and distort it. And so when you listen to so many of those songs, that is an acoustic guitar that's driving a lot of those, and not a big electric guitar. Which is also like, man, when you take a step back and you're like, wait, that's an acoustic guitar, like that has that massive sound. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's such a unique sound.
Oh, it's so interesting. And you know, like, what is it? Street Fighting Man was the amp that he used for that was the cheapest one he could find at some, you know, like a five and dime and he played it in a motel room. And
it's well, perfect.
When, you know, like Satisfaction was a mistake. I don't know if you've come across, I think you mentioned that in the book, where Satisfaction was always intended to be horns and the main guitar riff, but he recorded it.
I forgot about that.
Yes. He recorded it as like a demo, almost as like a placeholder that this is what it needs to be.
Yeah. Here's the part.
Yeah. Here's the part. But they put it in the mix. And I mean, you know, who knows it, you know, he's a colorful guy. So is that true? Like at what point?
I can see that being true. I can see that.
Well, he said, yes. I mean, it sounds like horns.
Yeah.
And he said that the only true recording of Satisfaction as it was written is Otis Redding's version, because in Otis Redding's version, he used horns.
So
when Keith Richards heard that, he was like, that's it. That's what it's supposed
funny.
To be. Yeah.
Man,
it is true. When you hear it, it's like, that sounds more like a horn section playing it.
But it ended up being an iconic riff that, man, when I saw them live a couple years ago, that song in particular, you know, you've heard that song, you've worn it out. There's hardly any life left in it. I feel like some songs I've heard so much.
Yeah.
And then they play that song live and it blew my mind. I mean, that is a song that came out 50 years ago, and I couldn't believe it. They're coming to Dallas in the fall, and I think I'm going to try to go. And that is the song that comes to mind. It was like, that was so incredible for a song that I thought there was nothing left in. They took it to another level. Anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and I feel the same way about Jumpin' Jack Flash, where it was like, that song means nothing to me. And, but it was the same thing where it's like, I've heard it so many times. It has no meaning. It has no impact. But then when I saw it live, that's usually their opener. I mean, I think it's been their show opener for years. Mm. But that's the same one where it's like, oh, I get it. Like, you kind of have to look at Keith Richards playing that song to realize, oh man, yeah, that's a hardcore song. You almost have to see the way he works his arm to play it. Then you're like, oh yeah, this kind of a mean song. It's awesome. Yeah.
That is awesome. Well, let's talk about guitar players. Cause they've had a few, but you've got Brian Jones to Mick Taylor to Ronnie Wood. I guess one, how do you characterize their sound based on the guitar player? And two, how do you think Ronnie Wood specifically changed the sound?
Yes, that's great. That's a great question. I mean, I absolutely think that that first era of the Rolling Stones that we were talking about, you know, leading up to open tuning, and there's a little bit of, you know, it's of overlap there for sure. But that early era Rolling Stones is, when Brian Jones was in the band, which has its own, I mean, they could make that's like a, you know, 10 behind the music, episodes, but in and of itself, and maybe even like an Unsolved Mysteries deal, but, like it's also a Dateline episode, but, because of his kind of mysterious death or whatever.
That's true. I'm laughing. I'm sorry, but yes, yes.
That is more of like the truly like British pop, early 60s British pop group. Right. I will tell you that, I mean, Brian Jones, and you know, of course Brian Jones is the founding member of the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
So it's no small thing. And I think that he was, I mean, everything I've read and heard, you know, just truly a genius, just a very kind of tortured genius. And I think that I can imagine that there were some issues with starting this band, and then the lead singer and the essentially rhythm guitar player taking over and writing all of the songs, and then being the ones that the public fell in love with, you know,
that'd be frustrating.
Wouldn't help, you know? Yeah. And I know that there were issues where he felt like things where he was being, you know, handled and mishandled. But you know, the interesting thing about Brian Jones, I mean, the lead guitar player, I don't know much about lead guitar players who essentially stopped playing guitar.
Yeah.
He got to the point where he wouldn't do it at all. Now, I will say that, Under My Thumb, Monkey Man, and even the opening of, other songs. I mean, his interest in, you know, percussion instruments like the marimba and all these other things. Oh, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, so we wouldn't have had that had he, you know, still been passionate about the guitar. So, I think that some of those, like Under My Thumb, is one of the best Stone songs, period. I think it's just an amazing song. But I think when you transition to Mick Taylor, that, you know, who is such a bluesy kind of, you know, kind of a bluesy jam guitar player, session player, then it's also when the Stones kind of transitioned into having more of a, not just in their music, but in their songwriting, you know, a lot deeper, much more depth to the material, and, you know, Exile. And starting with Let It Bleed. I definitely think that a lot of the most, I guess, hardcore Stones fans tend to be Mick Taylor fans.
Yeah, I think that's true. But do you think that, like, there was any resentment from fans when Ronnie Wood came along?
I think that that's a very different, I think that Mick Taylor, from what I know, and Ronnie Wood are polar opposites as far as personality, general personality. And I can see why you can have a Mick Taylor, who was, you know, seemed very serious. It was really all about the music, and, you know, of course did some amazing things. I mean, I know some Stone songs that you absolutely love, you know, you, and, yeah. Those are the ones where Mick Taylor can just go off. I mean, right. It'll just, you know, and they're incredible. And there were definitely some, I think, some personality conflicts and other things like that. But you know, there is no more obvious kind of rebound relationship than going from Mick Taylor to Ronnie Wood, you know, where it's like, oh man, that's Ronnie Wood. He has never been photographed when he wasn't either smiling or laughing. I mean, yeah. Over a period of like 50 years, you know, just fun and happy, yeah. And was already a good friend of the Stones. You know, I mean, inspired It's Only Rock and Roll. I mean, that's his quote. And that was on an album. I mean, that was on a Mick Taylor album. And so it definitely been a prevalent part of their lives as people and musicians. And absolutely, I think his personality infected the band in a great way. That's my opinion. I love Ronnie Wood. I love what he did for the band.
Me too. You know, it makes me wonder about, you know, I played in a band just for a couple of years, and I'm nowhere near the level of any of these groups I like to talk about. But there's so the thing that I remember is, you know, we changed drummers midway through the band, and the guy that came on hadn't traveled a lot before. And his comment was, I was surprised at how much of being in a band is relational. He's like, there's hardly any time you're on stage. It's mostly being around each other. And so I wonder, for a band like the Stones, like where you had had conflict of some kind with Brian Jones, like does a guy like Ronnie Wood or even Ringo Starr, did they just really help like even out this band of like maybe pent up creatives or whatever it is? But I feel that I can see how they would really like help smooth things over if you have an easygoing personality. And like you said, it just, he seemed like such a good fit.
But
you know, you talked about his playing specifically, and you said something that when I say you said, you and I were talking about it, and you mentioned how, isn't it interesting that Ronnie Wood has stepped into Mick Taylor's shoes, but he's had to embody Mick Taylor's guitar parts all these years. And that's something I had never thought about. Like, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that if you look at it as almost as a relationship, or, you know, a second, or I guess in this case, it would be like a third marriage, you know, where you think he's not just touring with them. You know, they're touring musicians. I mean, you know that, I mean, you see bands, you see concerts, and it's like, oh, okay. So this is the guy who's touring them with them as a drummer for this tour, or, or a keyboard player, or whatever. He joined the band, and they, you know, they married Ronnie Wood, and for years. I mean, well, that was in the early 70s. It's, you know, 2021 now, and they are still touring with Ronnie Wood.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. So there are many songs. I would say just some of the most amazing songs. Beast of Burden. That is Ronnie Wood and Keith Richards sharing the lead. That is what makes the Stones guitar playing so special.
Yeah.
Is that, it does not follow the hierarchy. It does not follow these set roles. They share the lead, which means I also share the rhythm. And, so he has these amazing original works, and look, let's be clear. Like, Ronnie Wood is an amazing songwriter in and of itself. I mean, I think one of the best, hands down, classic rock songs ever written is Stay With Me by Faces. I mean, between Rod Stewart singing and Ronnie Wood, and he wrote that. I think it is the most amazing song. So I mean, that's one song that you cannot turn up loud enough. It stayed with me.
Nice.
So a songwriter in his own right, and for years, you know, 50 years, he is touring. Well, it's not quite 50 years yet for Ronnie Wood, but he is touring and playing songs that another guy wrote. And to me, it's like, you know, they're his adopted children, you know, that he's not just playing them. He's playing them, and you've seen them live, and you've seen these tour, you know, shows. He's putting everything he's got into them night after night, sweating and laughing and jumping around stage to play Mick Taylor songs.
Yeah.
And how does that work? You cannot just do that And you can't be like Chuck Berry, where you walk on stage, play the song, get the check, walk out the door. You know, he is playing them as though he wrote them. Yeah. And I just think that that's fascinating that you can have that kind of love when you have your own songs with these people. You have your own, it's like, yeah, but we have us. And now you want me to go back and do stuff that was you and that other guy. I mean, that's where it's like,
that's interesting.
Somebody saying, oh, my boyfriend, I used to love to do this. And my boyfriend and I, you know, or my first husband and I would bake this dish together and it's our favorite. And it's like, so now I'm baking it the rest of my life. Like
that. Yeah. That's funny. I get what you're saying though.
Yeah. It's like, I just have never, I'd love to be inside, you know, a band member's head when it comes to stuff like that. What is that like?
I'm trying to think of what other bands that happened with. Like I'm thinking of like the Eagles and some of these other bands where different members were swapped out. But really Ronnie, I mean, 50 years holding the position. I can't think of anybody else that would compare to that.
Right.
But I, like you said, you can tell that he is all in it and he's given his all when he's doing it. And so it really helps kind of translate what was originally done into the current of what they're doing. So I think he definitely does that.
Oh, I think he's great. And I love, and like you said, the different personalities, I think that I can imagine, I don't know, obviously, but I can imagine if you have Brian Jones, who is so distracted and so not about the music, he was, you know, he had so many issues. He wouldn't even touch a guitar that you would react to that. The rebound from Brian Wood would be, I mean, the rebound from Brian Jones would be to get someone like Mick Taylor, who is only about the music and focus on that. And then I can imagine that the kind of the, you know, my impression that it wasn't a lot of fun, you know, that he could be a downer. He was overly serious and there were issues. Well, the rebound from that is to get your fun buddy who's always happy, always laughing. And that's Ronnie Wood. And it makes sense. And, you know, they speak so highly. You know, I know that Keith Richards in that book talked about how when he, you know, and at this point he's in his 40s, 50s, I don't even know how old, I can't remember, and decided to go back home to meet with his father. And it was, you know, a kind of a tortured relationship and had been his entire life. And he said, I had to bring Ronnie with me.
Huh.
And the whole reason was Ronnie makes you feel good. Ronnie makes you happy. He's kind of like a security blanket. He's your fun. He's like a Labrador, you know, and that how important that is to the band, and to Keith Richards, which, you know, that's no small thing when you're continuing to write music and record, to have that kind of confidence, that support.
No kidding. I totally forgot about that story from the book. And that is interesting. Certainly, compliments the group. We were also talking about like different styles within the band, and you brought up Mick Jagger's falsetto. Let's talk about the Mick falsetto era. Are you a fan of it or not?
I love it.
Okay.
I absolutely love it. My sweet spot for Stones music is late 70s. You know, I mean, I love it all. I mean, don't get me wrong. And by the way, one thing that's worth noting is that quick era, the Black and Blue album, which was really served as an audition for other guitar players. I think that probably my top five favorite Rolling Stones songs is was Hand of Fate.
Man, I listened to that today. Getting ready for this interview. That song is killer.
It is. And it's Wayne so Perkins. Good.
It's what? What'd you say?
The lead guitar is Wayne Perkins.
Is that right?
And yeah, it's not even he was never in the band. He was just, that was his audition song. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I just think that song is incredible. It is so incredible. And it was like a one and done for him. But Black and Blue is a fascinating album. It's not a great album, but it is fascinating. And it's also Ronnie Wood's audition album too, with, he brought some original riffs, you know, and that was when they decided to put him in the band, was based on that album. But anyway, I'm sorry, I just didn't want to, I was thinking about that earlier. I didn't want to forget it.
But, no, I'm glad you brought that up. I love that song.
But yeah, starting with Some Girls, you know, I think that that was, and that was really, I think that you're seeing a lot of Mick Jagger's influence, you know, and especially starting with Miss You, you know, where, and it's, you know, I've heard them talk about this and Keith Richards talk about this, where Mick Jagger, you know, he was the one kind of who had his hand on the pulse of popular music. And right. at that time it was disco and staying, you know, Studio 54 and hanging out at the clubs and convincing them to just go with it. When he described, like, telling Charlie Watts, you know, like, no, just keep that beat going,
yeah.
you know, just keep, and Bill Wyman, you know, like yeah. just having fun with bass and doing all the stuff. It ended up being one of their best songs. But going from that, I mean, that's, I love that album. And then, yeah, as it transitions, you know, from that into Emotional Rescue. I love Emotional Rescue, the album and the song. And that Emotional Rescue is like verse by verse. If you listen to it, Emotional Rescue is like slowly listening to, you know, like a junior high boy's voice change, where he starts off with that classic Mick Jagger falsetto.
Uh-huh.
And it gets lower and lower and lower. Each huh. verse, he goes from falsetto to just kind of a high singing to a low. I mean, like the like low for Mick Jagger. It's so interesting. I don't know where that came from. But I love falsetto Mick Jagger. It's like one of my favorites. And Tattoo You has some really good ones too.
Some great songs. And so we're talking, when we're saying these albums, Some Girls is 78, Emotional Rescue is 1980, Tattoo You 1981. I really think that, like, you know, you hit it on the head with when Keith Richards found that new guitar style, that ushered in one era of the band. But I really think that this, like, falsetto Miss You type era issued in a reminder to the popular culture, even, that this band is still relevant, because, like you said, Mick Jagger was the one who had the pulse of what was current. And I would give anything to be a fly on the wall trying to hear Mick Jagger convince these guys to do anything that like to do music that's so different for them. You know, they right. start as a blues band. But I don't remember where I heard it, but it was on some documentary with them, and it was basically their talk. I think Mick Jagger was the one talking about it, saying, we don't want to be the band that's out there doing XL on Main Street every album. He's like, I have no interest in doing that. I don't want to do that for 30 more years. And you know, well, they're doing it for 50 more years, but they've grown in that respect into being able to change and adapt to the times. And, you know, that falsetto singing is really part of that. It was a stylistic, interesting pop kind of thing that, man, they did it. They nailed it. They made it work.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, I mean, a huge leap forward was Some Girls, the album. Yeah. And yeah. I mean, and when you just look at the songs, I mean, it's always fascinating to me when bands can have an album with, you know, a hit or two, another album with a hit or two, and then they'll have another one and it has several hits. And you think, man, what happened in the recording of that? Like, how yeah. did they suddenly explode? I mean, right. of course, U2 has done that. I mean, U2 famously did that, but
yeah.
you know, and kind of reinvented themselves and did that. But man, Some Girls, between Miss You and, I mean, of course, Beast of Burden, one of the most amazing rock songs of all time, Shattered, which is, you know, I love that. That Shattered does sound so much like a club song from the time, you know, even like Before They Make Me Run. I mean, I always love the little Keith Richards songs that, you know, he would find a way to stick into the albums here and there, like Happy and Before They Make Me Run. It actually has my favorite guitar solo. It's just got that sound when you know that that guitar sound, which became so popular, but it's like, oh man, I love that. For whatever it is, it just kind of hits me in the right place. I love that.
I love him singing on Happy. That's always a song, you know, now I hear it and I can't not know that it's Keith Richards, but for the longest time I didn't put together that was Keith Richards singing that song. You know what wasn't fair to Keith Richards at the concert that I saw him at? It's like they stuck one song in the middle that was Keith Richards singing that I had never heard of. And it was probably off their most current thing. It was like a mass exodus to the bathrooms. And it was almost like I was like, oh, this is like, everyone knows this is like the spot where we're going to play a Keith song and you can go take a restroom break and then come back.
That's right.
So orchestrated. And I was like, maybe that's a common thing. I've never experienced it in any other concert, but I've never been to a Stones concert. So poor Keith.
Oh, I know. I mean, I think it is a bathroom break. I mean, the Keith Richards, yeah. Anytime he walks up to the mic, the first person in the bathroom is Mick Jagger. I mean, like that's true. What it serves that's as true. His bathroom.
Break. Right, right.
And, it's too bad because there are some great ones. I mean, but yeah, Happy is just such a good song. It is. And not only that, but you listen or read the lyrics and it is, man, it is a sweet, sincere song. And Before They Make Me Run, of course, is all about him, you know, that's right in the area where he was trying, the era when he was trying to get clean and get off drugs. And
that's the
whole point of the song is like, I've got to walk before they make me run. Like I've got to stop on my own before something happens. And something bad happens and I have to stop. And, same with both of those. Yeah. They're great stories about the actual recording process of him just being alone all night, just working on the guitar part, recording it alone. And I mean, Keith Richards, man, he's, you know, Mick Jagger is all show. I don't mean that negatively, but he is the ultimate performer, he is the ultimate entertainer. And Keith Richards is just all heart. I just think he's great. I think he's got a big heart and, but I sympathize. Yeah. When you said that about the concert, it's like, shoot, there's no way he doesn't know that. I mean,
right.
Everybody leaves.
Everybody heading to the aisles. Did you ever see, this is off topic, but we're just talking about Stones. Did you happen to ever see the John Mulaney sketch where he starts talking about, he's the comedian and he starts talking about how he used to write for Saturday Night Live and how Mick Jagger came on as a guest. Did you ever see this bit?
No, but I know John Mulaney. He's so funny.
He's so funny. He talks about how somebody asked him, what was it like when you worked on that one sketch with Mick Jagger? So Mick Jagger like was hosting the show or he was going to be in a sketch and the two of them had to work on a sketch together. And John Mulaney is throwing out ideas. And he was like, people ask if he's nice. He's like, no, he's been singing to stadiums for 60 years. And he was like, somebody was like, do you want it? And he was like, so I threw out a line like for the sketch, like, what if we say this? And he's like, no. And he yells it and points. And then he's like, how about if we say this? And Mick Jagger's like, yeah. And he goes, is that what it's like to be Mick Jagger? Like, I want a Diet Coke. Yeah. And it just happens. Anyway, it's a really funny sketch. And it made me think of this. Great. They're larger than life characters. And I think that's part of what made like seeing them such a thrill. And I can't say that for me, like seeing them just a couple years ago, it was incredible. And even talking to my father-in-law who saw him back in the 70s, we were talking about it and it was like, what, were they really good? I was like, no, hands down. This is one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. And so much of it has to do with the fact that they are carrying the torch of rock and roll still. And it's good. Like it was legitimately good. It's the second best show I've ever seen. I think U2 right after 9/11 is my top show, but
that's awesome.
Have you seen them a bunch of times?
The Stones.
Yeah.
I flew out to San Francisco to see them, about 6 or 7 years ago. And, it was such a great show that I'm afraid to see them again because I have like a perfect concert experience seeing the Stones. So I'm kind of afraid to mess with it. I'm not even sure if I'm going to go when they come to Dallas. But I might go, it may be too good to pass up, but yeah, I mean, I think that you're exactly right. I think that is the thing that anyone who kind of rolls their eyes at the Stones still touring, I'd say you just go see them. Yeah. I mean, they are undeniably great. Yes. And if nothing else, I don't care what age, you look at a human being jumping around and dancing and singing and going all over the place, nonstop, full intensity for like 3 hours.
3 hours. Yeah.
I don't know how a human can do it. And Mick Jagger does it every night. You know, it's incredible. Yeah. Everyone should see the Stones live.
No doubt. No doubt. Well, Blair, man, I really appreciate you coming on and talking about the Stones and these songs and specifically the time period where they really launched into their second half. And I think that's a good insight on the band. Just appreciate you coming on and chat today.
Oh, this is great, Ryan. I really appreciate it. I love your show. I'm a big fan. So I just really appreciate you letting me be a part of this.
Honored you come on. Thanks, man.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.